Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Today, we're sharing two real-life dramas with you, both very engrossing stories. One begins at home in Eugene, Oregon. The other ends on the beautiful shores of Kenya's Lake Naivasha. My second guest is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and he became intrigued with the subject of an article he'd written in 2006. He subsequently spent the next 3 years traveling backwards and forwards to Africa, searching for the truth about the life of Oscar-nominated wildlife filmmaker Joan Root. And his search culminated in a book that's been described as biography, love story, and thriller. Mark Seal joins me at around 12:30 today. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Deborah Gwartney. She's a former reporter for The Oregonian and worked as a correspondent for Newsweek for 10 years. She's on the nonfiction writing faculty at Portland State University and is the mother of four daughters and the wife of writer Barry Lopez. Her new book is called Live Through This, a mother's memoir of runaway daughters and reclaimed love. Deborah Gwartney, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, I was saying just before we started how honest I felt you were in this book, and everything I read as far as reviews hit on the same note. You were it raw emotion. It was very honest. It wasn't self-serving like many memoirs that we read. You've described the book yourself as a tale of motherhood, about a difficult time in your life, a time that made you rethink your views on motherhood. Tell us a little bit more about your book.
Well, my book is, I guess the dramatic part of my book, very dramatic, is that my daughters, my two oldest daughters, when they were 16 and 14, we'd been embroiled in, you know, first kind of typical mother-daughter difficulties, and then that just got worse and worse and more strained. And we were living in a town where they could meet up with a group of kids who lived on the streets who really kind of showed them the ropes of street living and eventually taught them how to jump on a train. And so when they were 16 and 14, they did jump on a freight train and disappeared. And my oldest daughter came back after 3 months, but my youngest daughter was missing for a year. And so the book, I felt, was really just taking a look at that year, how we got there, how we got out of it, how we found her, and just, you know, I feel like I became completely dismantled as a mother and maybe even as a human being, and I just had to put myself back together again. And so in order to do that, I had to take some hard looks at the ways that I had, you know, fueled their fire without even knowing it.
Mm. Situation that many people go through and, you know, don't always have the good fortune of reclaiming love as you do in your book,
in
your story. You begin the memoir on a bus. You're sitting on a bus. A young girl sits next to you. She reeks of alcohol and drugs and desperation. Mm-hmm. You feel irritated with her because this is still too new for you, and yet this is 10 years after your daughters had run away when this incident happens.
Right.
How long did it take before you could recall those memories and revisit that situation before you felt that feeling of wanting to run away yourself and not think about it?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I guess I feel like most of that has been purged now, and my relationship with the girls is fabulous. They're adults, and they're just doing very well, and we have a great relationship. But I still, you know, it's funny when those emotions just come popping up in me or just, you know, rise up in this kind of visceral way sometimes when I see kids on the street or when I see graffiti on it. I mean, not my girls didn't do the graffiti thing, but it just makes me think on trains, you know, that there are still kids who are jumping on trains. And, you know, it upsets me. Or I get lots of emails now, which are just lovely, about people whose kids have gone through this. And I just feel for them so powerfully still. You know, it's empathy instead of sympathy, because I just pull back into that same moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it'll just always be with me. It's a great grief, but I don't blame in any way my daughters anymore. I mean, we have solved all of that.
Mm. Well, there was a lot of blame that you placed on yourself and a lot of anger that you had towards your daughters at one point. But let's just go back a little. You were living in Texas.
Tucson,
Arizona. Mm-hmm. And you'd been unhappily married for a long time, decided to get a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
That is roughly when your troubles started with the girls, you think?
I do. You know, I think we were awfully young when we got married, and when we decided to split up, we just didn't, you know, neither of us were abusive or I mean, we both were clearly loving parents, but we really focused too much on each other and kind of lobbing grenades at each other. And I didn't see that at the time, but I realized in retrospect that I just didn't do a good job of making sure the girls felt safe and most of all that they felt like they didn't have to choose between their parents. I was saying all the right words, but my actions didn't live up to that.
Mm. So what kind of work were you doing at that time, Deborah?
I was a journalist. I was working for magazines and newspapers.
Mm-hmm. And you moved your daughters back to the Northwest. You moved
to
Eugene,
yes.
Oregon. You actually grew up in the Northwest.
I grew up in Idaho, yes. So I just wanted to get them back up where I would have more support and, you know, just felt more at home.
Yeah. Now, Stephanie is the younger one of the two.
That's right.
She was 14 when she ran away. Amanda mm-hmm. was 16. And you had two younger girls at home, too.
Right.
What was you describe in the book your relationship as being what you thought it was a fairly normal kind of family. You thought that blind love is going to hold us together. You insisted on family dinners and family mm-hmm. trips to the beach.
Mm-hmm.
Describe a little bit more to us what the situation was like before they actually ran away.
Well, you know, I think we had an arrangement where the girls were with me for the 9 months of school, and then they'd go to their dad's in Tucson for the summer. And I think what happened is that because when they were with him in the summer, they were just kind of feral children running around. I mean, he lived on a big patch of land, and they just, there were no rules or you know, I mean, he was keeping them safe, but it was kind of a free-for-all for the summer. And they'd come back, you know, just with all this tangled hair and torn clothes, and I would think, okay, I've got to shape these girls up. And I think I swung too far in the other direction. I felt like we needed to have, you know, dinner times, we needed to have bedtimes, homework times, we read together every night. And the girls just, the older girls especially, just balked against that kind of structure when they had this summer that was completely unstructured.
Mm.
And, you know, when I've asked Amanda about it now, she says that she feels like teenage girls, you know, kind of in a spectrum, of course, need a sense of freedom. They need that, the freedom to find themselves and discover who they were. And she felt like I just wasn't open to that. You know, they had dance lessons and art lessons, but these were all things that I had decided were good for them. And the girls now tell me that they felt like I wasn't really listening to what they needed.
Mm-hmm. And yet, from your perspective, here you are doing what all of the most psychologists tell you to do.
Yeah.
You know, the family that eats together stays together.
Right. Didn't quite work for us.
So you think you're doing all the right things there.
Yes, I mean, we were, you know, we didn't, my daughters have never had a video game. We didn't have cable television. We just had, you know, I really wanted to keep our lives about reading and talking and art and thinking, and it just didn't work for us. I mean, you know, the girls are hugely imaginative, and they wanted an adventure. And now looking back, I wish I'd provided an adventure for them, but I just didn't know how to do that.
Right. We were all geniuses in hindsight, though.
Aren't we?
Right?
Yes, and wonderful parents in hindsight.
But you do say that looking back, there were many things you wished you could change. But the first, I guess, would have been denial. You went into a state of denial, you said, during this period. And if you hadn't been in that denial, you said that maybe they wouldn't have run off. Because at this time, they were just taking off and not coming back at night once they were gone for 8 days, I believe.
Right.
Yeah. And so you just went at this point into a state of denial and just figured, oh, you know what, everything's going to work out.
Right. They're going to come to their senses. Yes, and the parents I've talked to since my book came out have all, or most of them have acknowledged that this is such a tempting state to be in, this denial, you know, that these are great kids. I mean, my kids were super good, wonderful little children, and I thought, surely they're going to snap out of this teenage thing, and they're going to see that I'm working as hard as I can work. You know, I had two jobs and four kids and no other adult in the home, and I wanted them to help me. You know, I kept thinking, you know, they're going to come around and they're going to be the helpful and cheerful kids they used to be. And I just was not letting myself see how serious it had become.
Mm. And a lot of the anger that they were building up was from the divorce, right?
I think it was, you know, I asked them about that now, and Amanda kind of ruffles at that. She says it's not really from the divorce, it's how you treated each other after the divorce. I think they were, you know, they weren't fine with us getting divorced, but they could accept that. But it's that we just kept, you know, kind of carping at each other, and they would come home and say, well, Dad says this, and Dad says that, and then I would say, well, you know, how dare he talk about me that way? And I think the same thing was happening there, and I just didn't, I wasn't mature enough to see what how eroding that was for them.
Mm. Well, you're human, right?
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Deborah Gwortney. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Thank you.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150. If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
No other station brings you this much variety. Welcome to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
What went wrong with our love? A love that was so strong. And as I still walk on, I think of the things we've done together, oh, while our hearts were young. I'm a walking in the rain.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and my guest in this segment is Deborah Gwortney. Her new book is called Live Through This. It's a mother's memoir of runaway daughters and reclaimed love. And Deborah, we were talking before the break about how Stephanie and Amanda left home, and their behavior was getting increasingly out of control. They actually left home. They ran away together. They had this very strong bond together, you said.
Yes.
Yeah, and there must, was there any comfort in the fact that they'd gone together? Or?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, it was both a comfort and a terror at the same time, one of those contradictions of human life, you know, where you feel both things at once. I couldn't believe that Stephanie, who'd been, you know, a star student and just successful in every way, I just couldn't believe she had done this. But I thought, well, at least maybe she's keeping Amanda safe. But in the end, it turned out that Amanda was keeping her safe. It was, they kind of were in different roles than I thought. I didn't really know, of course, where they were or what they were doing. So,
yeah.
So I was just scared every day.
Oh, I can't imagine. I can't imagine. So they started off on the streets of Portland, which is, mm-hmm. is you lived in Oregon, and mm-hmm. then word got around that you were looking for them. They jump on a freight train to San Francisco. Right. But you know, the thing that amazed me there was that Stephanie came home while you weren't there to get clean underwear.
Yes.
So, and then they jump on this freight train and go to San Francisco, and that's where they disappeared from you, right?
Right, yes. I mean, I knew they were in Portland, but I didn't know they were in San Francisco until later. I was sending out posters and calling up shelters, but it turns out that federally funded shelters will not tell parents if their children are there. That's part of the kind of deal they have with the kids is if you come here and we take care of you, we won't tell your parents where you are. So, you know, I have some problems with that. I just, I found out how much the system is really bent toward taking care of the kids, and there's really no help out there for parents. The assumption is that if your child runs away, then she's running away from an abusive home. So
you're automatically labeled guilty then?
Automatically.
Yeah.
And I could not get information or help from anyone. And I didn't want anybody to go find my kids. But I wanted to know if I called somewhere, I'd like to know if my child is there. Mm. But they wouldn't. They refused to tell me.
I read in an interview that you did that running away from home actually was decriminalized in 1974. And that's why the police don't really get involved in these situations. I did not know that.
Yes, it was a federal law that decriminalized it. Now, some states and some jurisdictions like counties or cities can make it against the law to run away, and some have, but federally it is not. It was decriminalized because of this very thing. They felt like the kids were being punished for running away from abusive homes. But now the pendulum has swung too far the other way, and I've been talking to this wonderful organization called the National Runaway Switchboard, and they are deep into this issue, and I really love the executive director there. And she realizes that parents are so frustrated, and she said that half of their calls last year came from parents saying, I'm desperate to find my child, and no one will help me.
Well, I was going to ask you that because you obviously have skills as a journalist, which I'm assuming involve investigative research skills.
Yes.
You know, but the average person doesn't. Where do they begin?
Well, you know, I think it's such a frustration because, and again, I'm getting all of these emails from people. You go to the police and they, you know, in a lot of places they'll say, sorry, we're just not going to help you. And, you know, I did have the, you know, the means and the intelligence or whatever to start hiring people. But, oh my goodness, I ended up spending a tremendous amount of money hiring people to go find my kids. And then that just stopped working.
Mm. You were angry with the girls. They were angry with you, obviously. But you were angry back with them. You felt they'd hurt you. You felt they'd damaged you collectively as a family.
Yes.
The two younger girls were affected. One of them would wake up crying because it was raining outside and she was concerned about them being cold. The little one would cross the highway bridge to go look for her sisters.
Right.
How did you cope? You say that you had some not such great coping skills, but you did get through that period. So how?
We did.
Yeah. How did you cope?
Well, you know, I think the way we coped was to not talk about them very much. We talked about it a lot when they first were gone, and then we just kind of were in this determined state of mind to have as normal a life as possible. And you know, so again, we were fixing dinner at night and sitting down and eating, and we did a lot of trips together. We went, you know, we read a lot together. We went to movies, things like that. But we just didn't talk a lot about the girls. And you know, I see that that was the way we coped and just maybe the only way we could. But I realize now that the younger girls were probably really suffering and just didn't know how to talk about, let me know how sad and scared they were. It was, you know, it was a very, I tried to keep it tamped down so we weren't living in this frantic state.
Right.
And yet
right.
I think we paid for that in the same way.
Right. You say you became almost, you created this self-made isolation, and in some ways that hurt you. How do you think that hurt you?
Well, because, you know, I let myself think, and I think a lot of parents do this, that I was the only one going through this. I made no effort to find other parents of kids who'd run away, or I mean, I didn't have access to the internet like people do now, and I'm really glad they had these blogs. I've found a lot of them where people are talking about it, but I just didn't do that. I just thought, I'm the only one going through this. I'm a bad mother, you know, and I let myself feel very guilty and wrong, and just kind of buried myself at home with the girls. I went out to work and came home, and I didn't make friends. I, you know, I just didn't do a good job of getting out in the community and saying, I'm somebody who needs some help right now and some support.
Mm.
And I think that would have been really good for the three of us. But instead, in humiliation, I withdrew.
Now, you, as I said in the beginning, very, very honest about your own feelings and your own shortcomings, as you put them. You say in the early days after your divorce, I sent signals I didn't mean. I was too depleted to fully love my daughters. They'd become a burden to a single mother, me. And talk a little bit more about that, or maybe have a passage that you want to read to us as well. But just talk a little bit more about your motivations, if you would.
Sure. You know, I think after I got a divorce, I thought, well, phew, that guy's out of our life. Now we can go on and have all this happiness. And we moved to another place. We got settled there. And I just didn't really realize, A, how hard it was going to be to raise four children by myself. I mean, even today, I'll go home sometimes and I'll think, how did I get all the laundry done? I mean, I just don't even remember how, I mean, I was working full time and had these four little girls who were very busy. And, you know, I think what happened was that I was exhausted all the time and on edge. And that, so they became, you know, kind of tiptoe around me because they didn't know, you know, they were so afraid of my potential breakdown, which I didn't break down, but I was tired and strained. And you know, I'd wake up in the middle of the night thinking, how am I going to pay the electric bill? And it was just way more than I thought I could handle it. It was more than I was ready to handle, but I did, you know, in the end, we did all right. But, and then the other thing is that I just didn't want them to talk about their dad. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty buried deep inside of me. And they wanted to talk about their dad. They wanted him to be part of their lives. And so I think they got the message to not speak about him and not address the fact that I was pretty tired.
Right. And, you know, many people are living in that situation, aren't they?
Yes.
Many, many people are living in that situation. You say, looking back, you wish somebody once had told you, oh, you know, lighten up, you need to see the humor in the situation. But
yes.
It didn't feel like there was a lot of humor in the situation
right.
then. But looking back, you wish you'd not taken yourself so seriously and
yes.
tried to paint a different picture to the girls about, you know, working and cooking and paying the bills.
Right.
But it's very easy, I think, for us to get caught up in that.
Yes, I think it is. And I really feel for single moms. You know, I don't know so much about how dads do it, but I really feel for single moms who try to have a fun and open household where other kids feel like they can come in and out. But, you know, I'd get home and I'd see a mess that the kids have made, and I'd just think, oh, my gosh, you know, another thing to clean up. And it was just a hard way to live, and I wish I'd just lightened up about, so what if there's a mess in the backyard, or so what if there are dishes in the sink? You know, I felt like I was not doing my job unless everything was tidy and controlled. And
right,
you know, I don't think of myself as a super over-controlling person, but I needed that sense of control to think everything's okay and we're going to get through this.
Yeah, I think we often do that. We displace one area of our life is out of control, we'll displace it somewhere else.
It's so true.
We want to take control of something else that we can control.
Dishes.
Yes, there you go. Now, Stephanie came home after 3 months. You say that to this day, and this is a number of years now, but to this day, you've never asked her why, and she's never offered a why.
Yes, well, Stephanie's the one who was gone for a year. And she's the one, I've just, you know, Amanda and I have talked about it quite a bit. She's the one who came home after 3 months. But Stephanie, you know, I always thought I was going to sit down one day and just say, okay, what was that all about? And for many years, I expected that she was going to grow up and come fall on her knees and apologize to me. But then, you know, one day I just realized we're done with that. I don't need her to apologize. and I don't really need to know. I don't need her to dig up that 14-year-old self and
right.
explain her to me. You know, Stephanie has just done so beautifully well with her life. I could not be more proud of her. And so whatever she went through, she got through it, and she's healthy now. And I just don't need to dig up the past anymore.
Right. And Amanda, the one who did come home after 3 months, is now living off the grid, you say?
She is. She took a lot of that kind of lifestyle and put it into a much more productive fashion. She and her husband live on a farm. They grow their own food. They raise their own animals, and they live completely off the grid. So they are self-sustaining people.
Mm. Well, we're almost at the end of our segment, Deborah. What would you like to leave our listeners with today? Because I'm sure there are parents or grandparents or aunts and uncles listening out there who may be in a similar situation or maybe can thwart a similar situation coming off.
Yes.
What would you like to say to them?
Well, I appreciate that opportunity. I think I would say first, you know, just forgive yourself for being human, like you said earlier. I mean, I wish I could have done that more often, and instead of burrowing in and being more determined, just to say to myself, you know, okay, I'm flawed, you know, I've made mistakes, go on, move on. But also that it's so good to talk to other parents, because there are many people out there suffering through this or trying to figure this out, and the more we can say that to each other, I think that the dark side of parenting in this country is just so rarely addressed. Everybody wants it to be this lovely, joyful, never any doubt kind of experience, but it's full of doubt, and it's you know, all of us get mad at our kids sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And they get mad at you too, at us too.
Yes.
Well, I really appreciate you being with us. It's a beautifully written book.
Thank you.
Very honest, very raw, emotional story. But the thing is, it turned out well. And I'm very pleased for you and for your family and your new husband, Barry Lopez. And where can listeners, read more about you?
Well, they can go to my website, which is deborahgwartney.com. And there are ways to get in touch with me there and read more about the book.
Fabulous.
And yes, I really appreciate that. And I guess the last thing I'll say is that my husband has been so fabulous to be in the girls' lives, and he really helped turn us all around.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much, Deborah, for being with us. Thank you. And Deborah's book, again, is called Live Through This, A Mother's Memoir of Runaway Daughters and Reclaimed Love, and her website, deborahgwartney.com. And Gwartney is spelled GWARTNEY. More at my website at conversationslive.net if you didn't catch that. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's AndreaKay.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals and paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs, I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Are you a worrywart? Do you lie awake at night, looping the same problem or concern over and over? Tune in next Monday at noon to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for some serious solutions. See conversationslive.net for full show details or call Vicki with your questions on Overcoming Worry at 206-414-6159.
Open your ears, open your heart, open your mind. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And today we're sharing two real-life dramas with you. The first with Deborah Gwartney, a mother's memoir of runaway teenage daughters. And in this segment, I'm talking with Mark Seal. Mark's been a journalist for 34 years. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and has written for many major magazines and collaborated on almost 20 nonfiction books. He lives in Aspen, Colorado, and joins us today to share the story of Wildflower, an extraordinary life and untimely death in Africa. Mark Seal, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vicki. It's a pleasure to be here to talk about this brave woman, Joan Root.
A very, very intriguing, very engrossing story. I was telling you before the show, I was kind of flipping through while I was on a teleconference and I got so engrossed I didn't know what the heck was happening on my call. But I wanted to just start off because you've written for, you're a journalist for 34 years, you've written thousands of stories, I'm guessing, and you say none has had or struck a chord with readers like this particular story. You started as an article and then, of course, it became a book. So tell us a little bit about how you heard about Joan Root
right. And
how you became intrigued with her story.
Sure. I was reading the Times Facts, which is just a paragraph or two about major news stories. And it was the story about her murder. And it just said, conservationist killed. Joan Root, 69, nominated for an Oscar for a film she and her husband did about termite mounds, one of the many films that they did together. It said she was murdered for unknown reasons in her home on Lake Naivasha in Kenya. And immediately I just thought, wow, who is this woman? I knew nothing about her. And the more that I investigated her, the more intrigued I became, because for a time, she and her husband were the most famous wildlife filmmakers in the world.
Mm. Now, I actually called my mother last night because they were on a series called Survival. And I said, do you remember? She said, I remember the series, but their name doesn't resonate with me. But it was a long time ago.
Right.
But you're going to let's read a little from your book. You're going to read a little from the book because it will kind of introduce Joan to us.
Yes, this part is the preface to the book, and she always believed that her husband left her for another woman, and that sparked her whole environmental crusade to save this lake. So this is the beginning. She always knew that he would come back to her. He would climb into his helicopter at first light one Nairobi morning and rise above the screaming madhouse of the city, tilting west over East Africa's largest slum, and flying out into wonder. Out over the great Rift Valley, the cradle of civilization, a 3,000-mile-long seam in the earth that stretches from Syria to Mozambique, but is at its most glorious here in Kenya. As the floor of the world dropped away, opening into endless sky and a breathtaking vista, he would follow this corridor straight back to her. There were things she longed to tell him, things only he would understand. Everything she had been too shy and self-effacing to say before would now come pouring out, just as it had in all of the letters she had written him, letters she never sent. These were the letters that she wrote. A lifetime has passed since we split, and yet some memories of things we did together seem as if they happened only the other day. There is so much I would like to say and share with you now that I know I am not inferior to you. She waited for him in her blue house beside the lake, which looked so perfect and placid from the air. But this was merely another extreme in a country where beauty coexists with unimaginable brutality, where the border between life and death is the thinnest of lines, where nothing is ever as it seemed. Now, in contact with others, she wrote, I realize how knowledgeable I am about the natural world. people respect me nowadays, but the only love of my life is one of the few people I cannot communicate with, even as a friend. She can leave all that pain behind as soon as he came back into her life, flying over the mountains and dormant volcanoes that form a natural amphitheater around the lake. He would hover over the emerald green water, taking in its wide, verdant, wildlife-infested expanse. And then she writes again, "When you flew over and saw the blue house, you probably were happy you didn't live here anymore. But I really am such a different person, I hardly know myself. I have written you so many letters in my head, but when I try to write, I go to pieces." She imagined him buzzing the house as playfully as he always had, then touching down on the grass landing strip and stepping out, as if returning from only a brief safari instead of half a lifetime. Then, at last, she would impress him with her independence and accomplishments and show him the abiding endurance of her love. Finally, he did come back to her, flying in with the dawn on January 13, 2006. It was not, however, as she had dreamed for so long. He hadn't come to reunite with the woman who had once been his wife, partner, and best friend, the woman he'd left to live alone in Africa for 16 years. He had come to collect her remains.
Yeah, very powerful. Now, Alan and Joan Root were together for a very long time, and you talked about this in the introduction there. He was the love of her life.
Right.
He left her for another woman, and she found herself after she'd left, even though, according to Alan himself, she really was the producer of all of these films that they made together, and she was the one who really propped him up and got him to where he was as a filmmaker, right?
That's right. Yes, he was the star. He was the charismatic individual with the ideas, and she was the person behind him who would always kind of take care of the little details. And for a time in the 70s and 80s, they were the world's greatest. Like I said before, they were mythical. You didn't just watch Alan and Joan Root on television or classroom screens across Africa and Great Britain. You traveled with them as they flew, swam, crawled, ran across Africa, you know, being bitten by every conceivable creature. I mean, they were just like Mr. and Mrs. Indiana Jones almost for
a
time.
And she matched him bite for bite almost. I mean,
she really did. I mean, she would be, when they did, there was a famous scene where they were filming a spitting cobra, and cobras only spit at eyes, human eyes. And so Joan was the target, and the animal, the snake would spit and right into her glasses. She would wipe off the glasses and say, are reshoots needed, you know.
Goodness
there
me.
There was nothing she wouldn't do.
Now, you got in touch with Alan, I believe, right after you heard about this story on the Times Facts. After
I did.
You heard about her, Jeff. So tell us how you got involved in tracing the stories.
No, as I always do, I'd never been to Kenya before. I'd never heard of Joan Root. I had no contacts there. But thanks to the miracle of email, before that faxes, you can contact people. And so I started emailing everyone that could conceivably could be connected to Alan. And I got a one-line email back saying, "I hear you're looking for me." And from that point on, he took me under his wing. He invited me to her memorial service. And later, when I started working on the book, because Joan rarely spoke, Alan gave me thousands of letters that she'd written to her mother about their exploits as the great wildlife filmmakers, as well as letters she'd written to him about their torturous divorce, as well as letters that she wrote that I just read, you know, where she wrote letters she never sent about how lonely she was without him.
Yeah, I think that's what makes this book so intriguing, for one, because you actually feel as though she's talking to you, because you actually print some of the letters here in the book
that
he wrote and that she wrote. Now, he seemed to be very ambiguous when they'd split. I mean, I have to be honest, I wanted to pick something up and throw it at him.
That's right. Yeah,
feel like that, or is that a common reaction?
You know, I liked him a lot, but, you know, the thing is that, you know, he did leave her for another woman. And the deal was that they had made with each other is that he would come back to her. But then the other woman came down with leukemia. She was only expected to live a year or two, and Alan was going to return to Joan after she died. but the other woman ended up living 15 years.
Mm.
And so Joan was left alone.
Yeah, the other woman absolutely cut Joan out of his life, and he allowed it to happen, too. And so did Joan, too. But
right. But the thing is about Joan that makes her so interesting and compelling is, after that happened, after she lost everything, her career, her husband, her best friend, her life, she didn't, after a period of total devastation, she grew back stronger, mm-hmm. more resolute, more mm-hmm. ready for the next challenge. So she wasn't this, you know, wilted flower. She was this strong, independent woman, which makes the second half of the book, I think, as interesting as the first, because she becomes a champion of the natural world, intent on saving this lake that was being ravaged by poachers and flower farmers.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, well, a great example of this was one of the first acts as a single woman. She got her pilot's license.
That's right. Yes, that was so great in my mind. Not only her pilot license, she started saving. Before, she and Alan thought their mission was, Alan thought their mission was documenting the natural world before it disappeared, to capture Africa on film before there was nothing left of it to capture. But he didn't think they were should be involved in saving it. After they divorced, Joan's mission was to save this world, to do whatever it took, to put her life on the line even, to save what she knew was disappearing right in front of her eyes.
Mm. Well, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about Joan Roots after the divorce and the work that she was doing as a conservationist following her days as a filmmaker. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Mark Seal. His book is Wildflower, An Extraordinary Life and Untimely Death in Africa.
If you like to read fiction, check out Book Talk podcast reviews brought to you weekly by Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Go to conversationslive.net and click on the menu at Book Talk to hear reviews of an eclectic range of books. We review fiction from chick lit and mystery to suspense and literary, from new to old, overlooked and forgotten. Check out Book Talk podcast today at conversationslive.net. If you'd like to suggest a book for review, email info@conversationslive.net or call 206-414-6159.
Thanks for joining us on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. If you have comments or questions on any of our shows, we want to hear from you. Email info@conversationslive.net, call Vicky toll-free at 800-495-7617, that's 800-495-7617, or leave a message at our special listener voicemail box, 206-414-6159. That's 206-414-6159.
More talk, less rock. Come on, that's a good thing. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest is journalist Mark Seal. He's currently a contributing editor for Vanity Fair, and he's written this fabulous book. It's described as biography, love story, thriller, about Joan Root, who was a wildlife filmmaker with her husband, Alan Root. And then the second half of the story is about her life after their divorce and her untimely death in Africa. So, Mark, after the divorce, we were saying she started coming into her own. She took her pilot's license. She became very passionate about conservation. Tell us a little bit about the kind of projects that she was involved in.
Well, the first thing she did is she started counting elephants. Elephants were being decimated across Central Africa. And she and Ian Douglas Hamilton began an elephant count that led to a lot of reforms in that area. Elephants were being slaughtered by marauding men on horseback with giant spears, and Joan was very important to in stopping that for a period. But then she returned home to Lake Naivasha, where she lived on 88 acres. And to describe Lake Naivasha as a wonderland is just not even telling half of it. It is the most beautiful lake in the Great Rift Valley of Kenya, and after you drive out of Nairobi, you crest the hill, and there in the distance, you just feel like the floor of the world dropped away. And you see there in the distance the shimmering lake. And that's where she lived. And it is one of the most beautiful spots on Earth. There's 1,200 hippos in the lake. There are giraffes, zebra. There's 350 species of birds. But when Joan returned as a single woman in the 1990s, the area had been overrun with flower farms, some of the biggest flower farms in the world. And while the perception of a flower farm is something beautiful, the reality is much different. First of all, the flower farms brought in huge numbers of laborers, poor people from across Africa. The population shot up from 30,000 to 350,000 almost overnight. And since flower farms mostly hire women, the men were left unemployed. And these are desperate men, young men, uneducated, and who couldn't find any other work. So they began poaching the lake.
And so we're talking about Joan Root and her conservation efforts. And she was very concerned about there was pesticide going into the water.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, yeah, she was concerned that they were, you know, the flower farms were sucking up water and spitting back pesticides. But the most concerning to her were the men that would come in armies across this land that she loved. And they were killing game that lived on the land, snaring game and killing it, also overfishing the lake. And, you know, she didn't really blame them because these are men who had nothing, you know, and what could they do? I mean, she felt for them. But at the same time, she was seeing the world that she loved disappear.
Mm. Now, you set out on this journey, on your journey, to find the truth about her life and death. Do you feel that you found that?
You know, I feel like I found the truth about her life, for sure, and about her crusade to save the lake. And I feel like I found the truth about what happened to her when, you know, two men came at 1 a.m. on January 13, 2006, armed with a panga, which is a one-sided machete, and a AK-47, and literally said, "Open up," and when she wouldn't open up, riddled her bedroom with bullets. And I'll tell you more about that in a minute. But I feel like I found the truth about all of that, up to who did it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's two schools of thought. I interviewed the police there at length, and they were convinced it was a normal robbery, that because by then, after, you know, the men, you know, what I left out is she began vigilante army, in a sense, to stop poaching on this lake. 15 men who she worked with, and they were determined to stop poaching, to teach the poachers how to fish responsibly and turn things around. After they had stopped poaching, the men who were doing the poaching turned to crime, and there was so much crime in that area. Joan had been carjacked. She'd been burglarized numerous times. She'd gotten threatening messages on her cell phone, and things got worse and worse and worse until finally she was living behind bars in her bedroom. There were steel doors around her. And these men said, "Open up," and when she wouldn't, they just unloaded their rifle and until she lay dead. So the police said it was a normal robbery. They thought that she had money in her home because she had been paying money to people, the poachers who needed money, the needy of the area, in addition to the men who were on this task force she had created. But all of her friends were convinced that it was an assassination because of her conservation activities around the lake.
Yeah, like so many before her in the African region, like Diane Fossey, for example, who she knew at some point.
Exactly. It's the same type of a story. Actually, Joan and Alan were the ones who took Diane Fossey to see the mountain gorillas when she was still a tourist from San Francisco. So they knew Diane Fossey well, and so many of Joan and Alan's friends had died in the cause of conservation. So Joan knew what she was up against, but I got the feeling that she also felt that she had to do something, and if she didn't do it, nobody else did. She would always say, "It's always talk, 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 meetings, 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 but nothing ever gets done."
You know, like so many things.
Yeah, and so she, at one point, became an activist. And she was the most unlikely activist because she was quiet, shy, never stood up, never sought the spotlight. But she drew a line in the sand at one point and stood up.
Yeah.
In an area where it's dangerous to stand up.
She looks shy, even in her photographs, the way she tilts her head. She has that Lady Di kind of tilt of her head.
Yes.
And she looks very genteel. I actually saw a photograph of her while I was doing some research on her, and she was sitting on her sofa at home, dressed up in high heels and a dress, and she had what I thought was a dog on her lap. She was trying to kiss and cuddle it, and it turned out it was a hyena.
I know. I mean, on the back of the book, there's a picture of her feeding a hippo.
Yes.
And hippos are the most dangerous, animals. The carnivore is the crocodile. Crocodiles kill more people than any other carnivore in Africa, but hippos kill more than any other herbivore. And Joan fed it by hand. I mean, she had a magical way with these animals.
Mm.
And the other part of it is she couldn't have children, and because she couldn't have children, a lot of people felt she turned her love toward animals. And so she was very tied up in this, and she was very tied up in animals. Those were her children in a way, and when she saw them being destroyed, I feel like she had to do something.
Right. And there's no doubt that she did an awful lot. I mean, she really did. You said earlier you'd never been to Kenya. So how did you get around? Did you have a translator with you? How did that work?
Yes, I did have a translator with me. And people in Kenya are so friendly. It's unbelievably friendly, hospitable place. I felt, after I'd been there just for a week or so, I felt so totally at home there. And, although I was investigating a murder, at the same time, people were very open, frank, and willing to talk about it. And also, Joan, for a person that was quiet and shy, had an enormous amount of friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of her friends, as well as Alan Reuter, her former husband, felt it was their duty at least to get her story out before the world, because they felt that if anyone needed to be recognized for what she did, Joan Root needed to be recognized. So I had that going for me, and that made all the difference, I feel like.
Yeah, and I was thrilled to hear that this book has been optioned, and they announced at Cannes, I believe, that Julia Roberts is actually going to play Joan Root.
Right. It was optioned by Working Title Films and Julia Roberts' production company, with Julia set to star as Joan, and I think she would be fantastic in the role.
Mm. What surprised you the most on your journey here? You had a lot of research to do. I'm sure you had to talk to a lot of people. What surprised you most about her story?
Well, I think it's the story that I felt like almost she had become every woman, every man, every person has this ability, this reservoir of greatness within them. And if circumstances force you into a situation, you're always able, if you really believe in something, to rise above loneliness, desperation, whatever, and stand up for something. She, like I said before, she was such an unlikely activist that if she became an activist, I think almost anyone has the ability to become an activist. And I just thought the bravery that she showed at the end was just so inspiring to me. And she just inspired me in so many ways, because I felt like she just grew so much into this amazing person from what she had started out as.
Yeah. And there's no doubt she loved Lake Naivasha. I read she was conceived there, and that too is where she died, unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, she loved this place so much. And it's a testament to what, someone who loves a place will do, to save a place, that's being endangered. I mean, there's so much about her. And when you read the letters that she wrote and the enormous love she had, not only for Africa and its animals, but also for her husband, Alan, and the life that they had together. I mean, I just think she's such an inspiring woman.
Yeah. And I said earlier I wanted to throw something at Alan, but he too loved her.
Yeah, he did.
He did.
Definitely. it's such an Africa story.
It is. It's an epic.
Everyone's so larger than life there.
Yeah. Well, Mark, we're at the end of our segment, unfortunately. I thoroughly enjoyed reading about Joan and her journey and talking with you about the book. What would you like to leave our listeners with real quick?
just I hope everyone enjoys the book, Wildflower, and I hope everyone realizes what a great woman Joan Root was, and I hope that her legacy lives on.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And my guest again, Mark Seal, S-E-A-L, and his book is called Wildflower, An Extraordinary Life and Untimely Death in Africa. Such a great, great story. That is a really great book. I want to thank you for being with us today and sharing this hour with us. If you have comments or feedback, you know where to reach me, conversationslive.net, or you can call our toll-free number at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. And we'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Are you a worrywart? Do you lie awake at night, looping the same problem or concern over and over? Tune in next Monday at noon to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for some serious solutions. See conversationslive.net for full show details or call Vicki with your questions on Overcoming Worry at 206-414-6159.